You're listening to the Morbid Curiosities podcast. We have no truck with profanity here, but those of you of a more squeamish disposition may wish to exercise caution before tuning in. Hello, and welcome to Morbid Curiosities, a new show about the morbidly curious for the curiously morbid. I am your host, George Colley.
And I'm your other host, Rosie Cole. We're the principals of
Jim Crack Productions,
a live theatre and performance company, and we make shows about topics which we research, and in this podcast, we share our research
with you.
So the topic we're talking about at the moment, in its many and varied facets and forms, is death.
Yeah,
we're on to the letter K.
Yeah, I've been thinking about it. Death. Dying. Passing away, going toes up, sleeping with the fishes, taking a dirt nap, you know, giving up the ghost, crossing the river Styx, hopping the twig, going the way of all flesh, assuming room temperature, reaching the finishing line, joining the great majority, slipping one's wind, buying a pine condo, going up Green River, yielding the crow a pudding, sticking one's spoon in the wall, tossing in the agate, running down the curtain and joining the choir invisible, going trumpet cleaning, tending towards a state of chemical equilibrium, deciding that hell's got a better PR policy than the office. Okay, so my topic this week is euphemisms for death.
But why is that YK in the death euphemism?
It's in honour of a death symposium, or death festival, if you will, which is going on at the moment, called Kicking the Bucket, which is, of course, a very popular euphemism for death. That symposium is currently going on in and around Oxford. It's running this year from the 24th of October to the 13th of November, with the apex of the festival having happened just this last weekend. There's still a week left of the festival. You can find out more about it if you want to by visiting www.kickinthebucket.co.uk. There are a lot of wonderful talks going on there. It's a highly educational symposium on death and the death industry and all the things that we find fascinating and worth talking about here at morbidcuriositieshq.org.
Sounds a little bit like life, death, whatever, that's just finished at Sutton House that was going on over the month of October.
And where we saw a couple of talks which were really, really fascinating.
Yeah, great work, you guys. It was such an impressive confluence of presentations, artwork, talks.
Industry insiders talking about their experiences and...
Very welcoming to those who are not in the industry. It felt like an incredibly positive and welcoming space and really creative and exciting. I hope you guys do it again. It was fantastic.
Included performance as well as informational and educational talks. There was an immersive Dracula. But best of all about it, it starts with a K.
What starts with a K?
Kicking the Bucket.
Oh, yeah.
Which means I have a topic to do this week on the podcast. K is for euphemisms.
No, it's not. Euphemisms begins with E.
All right, you've got to take a couple of steps, but... Which is why I reeled off that long list earlier. A list which doesn't even begin to scratch the surface of how many euphemistic terms there are and have been throughout history about death. There are literally thousands of the things from all across the history of the human race and all across the world. That list I started with really could go on for hours.
It seems a bit like we have trouble talking about death directly.
That was a large part of what I wanted to talk about today. Death euphemisms, particularly those in demotic English, tend to be very succinct. Bought it, croaked, snuffed it, popped it.
Carked it.
Carked it, that's a...
Drowned it, squished it.
Fell off a bridge, it.
And I think... Smushed it.
And I think that's very telling.
Ate it, bought it,
already. Repetition. I think that's very telling about what they're particularly for. We use euphemisms when a situation is delicate, or as a way of getting past speaking about it directly, or even we use them to signal particularly that we don't want to talk about something. That's why there are so many in particular for sex and death. Folks at home, see how many euphemisms you can come up with sex and how many for death. I'll bet you there are more of the latter. And if you're in public, do that thinking out loud. The point being, yes, it's a great sign, the number of euphemisms that I could find out there. It's a great sign of how uncomfortable people tend to be about having these conversations.
Tell me a bit more about where some of these euphemisms have come from, because as some of you listeners may have guessed, I'm a bit of a nerd and I really love nerdery about language. Etymology is really cool.
Well, you sit back and let me educate you. That's not a euphemism.
Oh, sorry, I'm getting confused.
Well, we'll start with kicking the bucket. Where do you suppose, without reading my notes, the origin of the phrase kicking the bucket actually comes from? Without reading my notes.
Someone kicked a bucket and it hit someone in the head and it killed them.
Close.
Really?
No.
Oh.
There are flimsy theories that the image it's supposed to conjure is of someone hanging themselves, standing on a bucket, throwing the little noose over a beam and then kicking the bucket away from underneath them. I think that's a very, very tenuous theory about it. It doesn't seem to have much historical support. Rather, the word bucket in this context most likely means something else entirely. In 16th century England, bucket could mean a beam or a yoke, derived from the French words bouc, meaning a yoke, or trebuchet, meaning a balance. So it's possible that the literal act of kicking the bucket while being hanged from it is the origin of the phrase.
As in a gallows, like the beam of a gallows, or a yoke from a gallows. Oh, I get it.
A lot like
and
that.
Kicking.
Specifically referencing gallows, as Shakespeare says in Henry IV, Part 2, swifter than he that gibbets on the brewer's bucket. Also, in animal slaughterhouses, there was a wooden frame which was used to hang up animals for slaughter. They were hung upside down, obviously, with their feet close to the bucket.
The bucket is in the beam.
The beam.
And, so
and when the act was done, they would jerk and, in fact, directly kicking the bucket.
Well, that's enough of that one for me. Can we move on, please? Thank
you. Of course,
you.
Yeah.
Let's pass on to the next one.
What an amazing coincidence that you said that after reading my notes. Passing.
Notes? What notes? We don't have notes. We just
no,
know
we
these things.
Store all this up in our brain tanks. Passing away or passing over. This one deserves a mention particularly, I think, because going by a few of the articles that I've turned up in my research, passed or passed away, as well as being apparently the oldest synonyms for dying, they seem to be the ones which stretch back furthest into history in the English language. It seems to be the industry standard within the funeral industry at the moment. And I emphasise that that's only according to a few individual opinions and findings that I've turned up. It's the opinion that I could most correlate. Listeners, if your experience of the industry is different from that, then I apologise. I mention this because I think it's possibly problematic. Aside from the standard difficulty with using euphemism as a way of speaking directly about death, which is a healthy thing to do, I think, Passover or pass does imply and does have its origins in the idea that the person has gone on to another state of being or another world or another part of life. And I wanted to get your opinion on this, Rosie. It's a tricky one because it's not necessarily meant to imply that any more than I'm invoking the Son of God when I lose a game of Darkest Dungeon and scream Jesus at the top of my lungs and rip some of the stuffing out of the sofa. But I wanted to pose that idea to you, that having something so ingrained in the vernacular, which is also particularly suggestive of the fact of a specific religious idea or a specific article of faith, I'm wondering if you think it's harmless.
That's an interesting question, because language and the way we communicate is very powerful in indicating our beliefs and view on the world. If you study communication, there are layers and layers of meaning contained within one word that people can or cannot receive. It could be that one person says passed on with a very religious meaning and the person talking to them doesn't infer that because that's not where their thinking is.
Exactly, yeah.
I don't necessarily think it's harmful. I would say it's more like evidence that we are a society that is predominantly a Judeo-Christian society, or at least has been for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and thousands of years.
And linguistic foibles like that are so ingrained into the language that they don't necessarily...
Well, I don't even know if they're foibles. I mean, language is plastic. It evolves. Mm. So it may once have had deep religious significance, but I think as we become more of a secular society, language changes with us rather than tethering us to previous ideas. So I think I've answered the question as in no, I don't necessarily think it's harmful.
I think you have answered the question beautifully. Let's look at a few others. Giving up the ghost. Though the idea of a ghost or spirit leaving the body upon death sounds likely to have been ubiquitous throughout human history, the phrase in English seems to have very specifically biblical origins. Acts 5 verse 5 in the Tyndale 1534 translation. When Ananias heard these words, he fell down and gave up the ghost. Acts 12:23, I'm not sure which Bible translation this is from, but immediately the angel of the Lord smote him because he gave not God the honour and he was eaten up of worms and gave up the ghost. Mark 15:37 in the King James 21st century Bible, and Jesus cried with a loud voice and gave up the ghost. It's one which has crossed over into vernacular, and I think in modern English it's considered a more glib terminology than would be suitable for describing a dead person. I don't think many people in general would, in seriousness, use give up the ghost to talk about someone who'd actually died. I think it's more aptly applied to a toaster. when it stopped giving out the toast.
The ghost toaster from last week.
I would use the most reverent language available to me if the Poe toaster that we were talking about last week were found to be dead.
Give me another one. I like these stories.
Crossing the River Styx is a pretty obvious
that
one.
That comes from classical mythology.
Greek mythology. The river which formed the boundary between Earth and the underworld, also called the River of Hate. Styx is also a deity and a master of shadows. Less obvious is going up Green River.
River Styx isn't green. Actually, maybe it is green. Who knows?
You don't know. You weren't there.
I don't know. Sidebar.
Sidebar.
There didn't used to be a word for blue, did there?
That's right.
And they talk about how in the Iliad, where Homer talks about the wine dark sea, and everyone just assumes it's talking about blue, but actually he doesn't mention the sea being blue at all.
References to the sky are as bronze. The sky is described as bronze and the sea is wine dark. And that's, supposedly there are ways that you can test whether or not someone recognises blue as opposed to green.
We're getting into like perception and brain science now. This is a bit much. Tell me more about language.
Let's save that for another cabinet. Although I really do want to talk about it.
The brain cabinet of brains.
We don't want to digress too much, but do look up recent scholarship and studies into the existence of the colour blue. It's fascinating. And it's not just about that dress on Facebook.
The blue and black dress.
Moving on. Going up Green River is another euphemism for death. This took some digging to find out what the origin of this phrase was, but I think it's a good example of how obscure and varied the origins of these phrases can be. Obviously, I grant that going up Green River is, out of the list that I'm reading up here, probably the least well-known.
I've never heard of that.
Beavers.
Who were?
In the 1820s to the 1840s, the beaver trade in far West America was thriving. Who were? And a certain well-renowned production centre for knives was located in a place called the Green River Works on the Green River in Massachusetts. And on the base of the blades for these knives was stamped Green River. A few other brands which wanted to exploit the popularity of those knives stamped them with Green River too. So to go up Green River meant to have a knife in you all the way up to the hilt, which is bad for your health and occasionally leads to deadness.
I have heard that if you put a knife in you up to the hilt, if it's not one of those prop theatre knives, kind of in trouble.
It depends on where you put it into the hilt.
I'd say anywhere in the body is usually pretty bad, but there are some worser areas.
Listen to some sage words from an actor. If you put it between your upper arm and your torso, it looks like it's gone in and the audience believe it.
Right, in the negative space there, not like in the ribs between your upper arm and your torso.
I tell that story to demonstrate the variety, the range from which these stories can come. While I don't expect a huge number of our listeners to have heard of it, it is a death euphemism in circulation, and it originated from a very, very specific point and set of circumstances. Buy the farm. You heard that one?
Yeah, bought the farm.
He bought the farm.
Please don't ever do that American accent again, please.
He bought the farm.
No, please stop.
Johnny bought the farm. I'm from Boston and Wisconsin.
No, you sound like a bad robot trying to speak with an American accent.
Buy the farm. You heard that one?
Yes, I have.
So this is definitely a 20th century phrase, but beyond that, its origin is a little bit harder to pin down. It seems to apply specifically to death in military action or an accident, and there's evidence that it started in particular as jet pilot slang. I've come across a few different explanations which seem a bit overly specific, and one which fits the bill to me very well. The first one, which I think is unfeasible, is that the phrase started out referring very specifically to when a pilot would crash into farmland, and the money from the resulting lawsuit, when the farmers or the family owning the farm could sue the government, would be enough that they would be able to pay off the mortgage. Therefore, the pilot kind of bought the farm with his life? A bit more likely is the possibility that farm is actually a bastardization or a development of the word plot, as in cemetery plot. However, most likely of it all seems to me that if a serviceman was killed, his family back home would receive a payout from standard military life insurance, and that'd be enough for them to, for example, pay off the family mortgage. I like both of those last two explanations, though. I like the idea of a farm as a plot.
Oh, I've got one for you.
Go on.
I've got one. Pop your clogs.
Pop your clogs?
Where does that come from? Because I'm just thinking of, like, balloon shoes.
Are they made entirely out of balloons, or are they just clogs with one balloon sort of hanging off?
No, if you got a balloon artist to make you some clogs.
Yeah, they wouldn't last long.
and you'd pop your clogs. But I wouldn't want to die from that.
People would be dying all over the place.
I wouldn't want to die from my balloon shoes.
Pop your clogs full of foot poison.
Like, how could you...
Interesting bit of British history that's associated with that phrase. Did you know that in the mid and early 20th century, in the Midlands and Northern England mostly, but all over the country in parts, most people working in manufacturing or in industrial jobs would in fact wear clogs to protect their feet in the factory? Wooden shoes.
It's like steel-toe cap boots.
A little bit, earlier. But wooden and significantly worse.
Yeah, but like...
Have you ever put on a pair of clogs?
No.
It's awful. The phrase pop one's clogs could have meant a few different things. Pop could mean pawn, as in the song Pop Goes the Weasel, which is referencing the sad, sad times when the family weasel would have to be pawned back in the days to pay for grandma's heroin habit.
What's in that tea you're drinking? If you pawned your weasel to pay for your LSD habit, what is this?
I don't have a weasel or an LSD habit, thank
no,
you very
much. No, you pawned it.
A weasel is a kind of iron. Pop Goes the Weasel in the song refers to the family's money running out and the weasel would have to be pawned. Up and down the city road, in and out the eagle, that's the way the money is spent. Pop goes the weasel. The eagle's a pup.
I didn't know that. I just thought it was a fun song about an overexcited rodent.
Well, if you think about the pop one's clogs thing too much, obviously it's referencing you not needing your clogs anymore so you can pawn them because you're dead. But...
Your family can pawn them.
Oh, yeah. I was going to say it didn't make any sense because you wouldn't need the money, but your family
would. If you're working in the factory, your family could pawn your shoes.
You're not making money anymore.
Pop the clogs.
But they can...
To save the weasel.
Pawn a pair of wooden shoes and live off that forever.
Pop the clogs. Save the weasel.
Pop the clogs to save the weasel. Phrase of the day, ladies and gentlemen, means nothing.
Wow.
The other possibility is that the original phrase was cock one's clogs, as in to have them at a cocked angle. If you just imagine someone fallen dead on the factory floor wearing clogs, they'd be at a canted angle. Yeah, it's a bit tenuous. I prefer pop one's clogs, as in to save the weasel. Pop the twig.
That's not a euphemism.
Apparently it is. Difficult one to drag up any information on.
That's because it's not a real euphemism.
The first example of it is traced back to 1797 in a book called Walsingham by a Mrs. Mary Robinson. The quote is, "He kept his bed 3 days and hopped the twig on the fourth." And originally in that context, it seems to have meant just to go away suddenly, possibly to avoid creditors. So it seems to me, and this is speculation on my part, that it may have developed as a bit of gallows humour about dying as being the only way to avoid the tax man. It may also be a more succinct variant on dropping off the perch. A few more here. Climbing the golden staircase. It's another biblical reference, obviously. There are plenty of those. Biblical influences all over our vernacular, as we discussed.
Bible, get off my vernacular.
I don't know what the staircase down is made of. What do you think the one down is made of? Putting on a pine overcoat. That's pretty...
I like that one a lot. What?
I just really wasn't expecting that reaction.
I just like it.
Wearing a pine overcoat.
Oh, that sounds comfy, just like the wooden shoes.
This is a pretty simple one. Pine overcoat, I think, is a fairly obvious reference to a coffin, and I couldn't find any evidence that it suggests anything else. I'm sorry if we're losing the plot, folks at home.
We lost are the both... funeral plot, ran out of money, had to pawn the weasel.
Oh my god! The only reason I suggest a pine overcoat is so that I could segue to mentioning another podcast which our listeners might find interesting, and that's Wooden Overcoats, a fantastic little narrative comedy show which is now in its second season. It's about the trials and woes of a funeral director called Reginald Funn in the island community of Piffling Vale, and I highly recommend it. That's Wooden Overcoats. Look for it on iTunes or whichever back alley podcast dealer you use. Just going to mention one quick one to finish, which I like. Casse sa pipe.
That means to hug a baby chicken.
So close. To break one's pipe. Probably military in origin and refers to when surgeons would have their patients bite down on a clay pipe while they operated. Supposedly if the clay pipe fell from their lips and broke, it was because they had popped their clogs, passed on, gone trumpet cleaning, bought the farm.
Started pushing up daisies.
Shuffled off this mortal coil. They were dashed to pieces, cold as stone, dead as a doornail. Those last four were all Shakespearean. I was hoping to put together a huge list of Shakespearean euphemisms for death, but I could only find four.
Need to read more Shakespeare.
I read the complete works this morning.
All of them this morning?
Yep.
The whole thing?
Yep.
That's really interesting because it's got really small text.
Mm-hmm.
Do you find anything interesting in... Hang on, we're digressing.
We are sort of spinning off track a bit, aren't we?
Yeah.
Are these segues working into the direful digression?
Oh, God.
Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen, for listening to our podcast.
We appreciate your...
You.
We appreciate your listenership so much. Every week we have a listener question.
Mm-hmm. So last week's listener question was...
Have you ever seen a ghost. We asked you for your ghost stories, and my God, you didn't disappoint, friends. So, Kim started us off. She said she believed she'd seen a ghost. She was about 12 and woke up in a blue room she didn't recognise. As she blinked the sleep from her eyes, she saw a pair of white hands over near the door. She was paralysed with fear. The hands floated over to her and grabbed her around the throat, choking her, and she passed out. She woke up sometime later and realised she was in her cousin's friend's flat. She went to the bathroom and looked at her neck, and she had bright red marks around the sides. And for years, she was convinced it was a ghost until she learned that she suffered from sleep paralysis.
Oh, and wow, that's terrifying.
It was actually a hallucination. We'll probably at some point in the future of this podcast do an episode on sleep paralysis, but it is a pretty scary phenomenon. Thanks for sharing that, Kim, and I'm so sorry that that happened to you. Rosemary had a really scary one.
Haunted hotel.
Yes, she was staying in a hotel and she always sleeps with the bathroom light on so she doesn't get disoriented. And when she woke up, there was a man standing next to her bed with shoulder-length strawberry blonde hair and a blue-grey suit with a tailed jacket. He paused for a moment, then started running around the room, looking worried, stopping in different places and looking back over his shoulder. Rosemary started screaming, but he didn't acknowledge her. He then ran back towards the bed and then through the end of the bed, out the door to where the bathroom was. She got up and ran into the bathroom, screaming, ready to attack him, but the bathroom was empty and the hotel door was still chained from the inside.
Creepy.
In the morning, she told the hotel, and they asked what he looked like. They said although there hadn't been any reports in that specific room, they'd add it to the list.
Wow.
Yeah.
Let's take the name and number of that hotel and never go there.
Yeah, and she asked a little bit more about it, and apparently they told her that some of the rooms aren't booked for the guests as there's so much activity, and in some corridors, the night porters talk to the ghosts. I want to know which hotel this is.
Yeah, I want to go stay there.
Roxy has seen figures and things before, but she usually put it down to her brain hallucinating. But apparently recently she's been seeing her old dog running around her house, which she finds very comforting. That's very sweet.
That's sweet.
And she said when she lived in an old Victorian house in London, it felt like there was some kind of presence there who used to take care of her when she got ill. And it felt like a young, fun presence, like a little girl. But if she had a fever, it felt like there were cold hands on her head and a breeze coming out of nowhere that her boyfriend at the time couldn't feel.
Feeling cold hands on your head.
When you have a fever, that's quite nice.
Yeah.
Al.
Good old Al.
Our most frequent contributor actually knows, worked opposite.
A ghost.
The haunted McDonald's in Eltham that we referenced last week. It was amazing. Al, you're famous. You know the haunted Eltham McDonald's. Apparently that's true. Apparently it's built on some crypts. That's pretty cool. And he also posted a video of a friend of his saying his farewells to his old husky by scattering his ashes. And he posted a film of the scattering of the ashes. Mm-hmm. And in slow-mo, as he throws the ashes into the air, it looks like the ghost of a husky.
Forms the shape of a galloping dog. It's really, really good.
It's amazing. Oh, Vivacity says she's never seen a ghost, but she heard in her flat in Edinburgh on a handful of occasions, they were all awakened by the sound of a desperately panicked man running down the corridor, but no one ever had the courage to look. And then she also said she felt strongly that on the Day of the Dead, she felt that her mother was beside her, like the space being occupied, the weight on the couch and the warmth of a body nearby.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's really beautiful.
Who else we got here? Ash.
Yeah. Ash does a show about ghosts and haunting. So Ash says he used to believe in ghosts and even thought he felt them around him. But after 2 years working in what is claimed to be the most haunted location in the world, which I believe is the Edinburgh Vaults, either turns you into a hardened believer or a hardened skeptic. And he turned into a hardened skeptic. But he always used to think that he saw an old woman in one of the vaults stooped over and staring. As he learned more, he realised it was a mixture of the brickwork, the lighting and the corner of his eye not having the full information, so his brain filling in the gaps, which is pretty interesting, the way your brain...
Yeah, the way your brain can finish up patterns.
Zhuzhe La Folle. Her sister swears that the front room of their family home is haunted by a little girl, and the ghost apparently once asked her sister why she was talking to herself when she was getting ready for school one morning.
That's a fun family moment.
That's kind of creepy.
What about you, Rosie?
No, I don't think I've ever seen a ghost.
Not at all?
No. no ghost. What about you?
Well, I used to, I don't believe that I have, but I used to occasionally be sort of haunted when I was going to sleep by a vision of a scary figure from a video game.
So? It's not really...
No, no, certainly not a ghost, but I was struck by how sort of, how alarmingly present this thing seemed to be. Whenever I would be falling asleep and there was an open door. Very tall, very terrifying, looming figure. So thank you, Ben Croshaw, for haunting my dreams.
What's this week's listener question?
This week's listener question will be, what is your favourite euphemism for death? Or, why don't you make up a new one?
Oh, yeah. That sounds great.
Yeah, come up with a new death euphemism. Maybe one which would be specifically fitting for yourself.
Or just tell us your favourite.
And why?
You can tell us that through a variety of modern technological communicatory means.
For example, you can tell us on Twitter at...
Jim Crack Shows.
On Facebook at...
Jim Crack Productions 1.
On Instagram at...
Jim Crack Productions.
Or on our personal website...
JimCrackProductions.com. You could even tell us in person if you wanted to by coming to one of our shows.
One of our mini shows.
Yes. So the main one we've got coming up is our Death Positive Extravaganza,
Moribund!
And that starts on Tuesday the 22nd of November at 9 p.m. at the beautiful Crazy Cox
Brasserie Zadel
in the heart of London's Piccadilly. It's going to be fabulous. Tickets are still available from the Brasserie Zadel website, so please do check it out. We've got links plastered all over our social media, so book it and come and tell us that you're coming because we want to say hi.
It's a beautiful venue and a fantastic show, if I say so myself. Well, that was direful.
Was it really that bad?
No, I could live with it.
You didn't feel like you were going to pop your clogs anytime soon?
I'm never going to use that phrase again now.
Is it because of the weasel?
Or sing casually, pop goes the weasel, as I always used to when doing the washing up, as you well know.
You've never done that.
What, the washing up? Yes, I have, I do.
No, I mean the singing while you do the washing up.
Fair. So what's L for?
L is for living will.
Living will?
Yes.
Will's not dead.
Some wills are dead.
Will Shakespeare? He's dead?
Yes, he's definitely dead. A living will. Not many people think about living wills, unless you're thinking about your friend Will, who is alive. But what I'm talking about is otherwise known in this country as an advanced decision or an advanced statement, which essentially comprise a living will. In America and sometimes Scotland, they're called advanced healthcare directives or advanced directives.
Okay, that gives me a pretty good clue as to what they contain and mean.
An advanced decision and an advanced statement are two different things, but they're basically two ways to make sure others, including doctors, know what you want for your health and care toward the end of your life, particularly if you become unable to advocate for your own healthcare in any way.
So if, for example, you have a neurodegenerative disease and you can't make decisions in the way that you could.
Yeah, there are multiple reasons for why you may not be able to enact your wishes for care. So it is very important to have one of these. It may be a distressing conversation, but I urge everyone to have it. So the two elements that go into a living will are the advanced decision, which is the legally binding document that discusses medical treatment for the end of your life, often refusing certain medical treatment. Or it's possible in your advanced decision to put that you would like all the medical treatments to keep you alive, no matter what cost. So It's really up to you. The point is you've made the decisions about your medical care. That's what an advanced decision is. An advanced statement is to do with your preferences and wishes, and they are not... An advanced statement isn't legally binding.
Ah.
It is more about your care in the longer term, not necessarily medical care. And it can be as detailed or not detailed as you like.
I see.
They can be linked together, or you can make them separately, or you can make one, not the other, depending on what you prefer. I strongly urge everyone to make at least an advanced decision or an advanced healthcare directive. That, to me, is the big one about what kind of medical intervention you want, if any, should your mental state be compromised. This is not the same as euthanasia or asking loved ones to participate in assisted suicide. That is not what this is for. Assisted suicide and euthanasia are currently still illegal under UK law. And that is a discussion for a whole other podcast.
If I have these two things, so what could they entail?
So basically it's planning how you wish to be treated if you become seriously ill. And that could be really helpful for people who are still around to care for you, especially if you lose the ability to make your own decisions. So the advanced statement allows you to express your preferences, wishes, beliefs, and values. It's gonna tell those caring for you of your likes and dislikes so that decisions are made in your best interests. So this is the non-legally binding one, the statement. It's your own statement of what you would like those who care for you to take into account when making decisions on your behalf. So, for example, it could include how you want any religious or spiritual beliefs you hold to be reflected in your care, where you would like to be cared for, like at home, in a hospital, a nursing home, a hospice.
Mm-hmm.
How you'd like to do things. For example, if you prefer a shower or a bath, or like to sleep with the light on, if you prefer tea or coffee, it can be that detailed. And practical issues as well. For example, what to do with your pets if you fall ill and are unable to care for them. So this is all your sort of lifestyle preferences. It's really important to talk to your loved ones about these things. None of us like to think that anything bad is going to happen to us or our loved ones, but I think in the interests of avoiding a huge amount of heartache and stress and worry in the future, it's worth having a difficult conversation now rather than later.
Absolutely.
So that when you're faced with something potentially awful, or if you're faced with something potentially awful, you're not adding to that worry by wondering what that person would want you to do in this situation. An advanced decision is the legally binding document that describes the specific illnesses or conditions that might arise in the future and allows you to say what treatment or treatments you would like to have or refuse under each circumstance. This will ensure that your wishes will be followed to the letter by those caring for you. If you don't have an advanced decision, healthcare professionals will make treatment decisions on your behalf. And an advanced decision is particularly important if you develop something like severe dementia, or you fall into a coma, or lose the ability to communicate due to a stroke or a head injury, or any other kind of reason that may incapacitate you and take away your decision-making faculty.
Right.
You should have an advanced decision. It lets your loved ones, your family, the people who are caring for you, the healthcare professionals, know whether you want to refuse specific treatments. For example, ventilation or CPR. You might not want that, depending on what state your physical body is in.
You may want a total DNR.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly what an advanced decision is. Do not resuscitate.
Do not resuscitate.
Exactly. You can put that in your advanced decision if you don't want to be. And there are many good reasons why people might not want to be. Then again, there are many good reasons why people might say, no, keep me alive at all costs. Resuscitate me. Put me on a ventilator. Whatever happens, I want this. So you can put both in. You can get as detailed as you want with this, because there may be some situations where you would want to refuse a treatment, and then in other situations you may not want to refuse it. This is something that you can do with a doctor's advice. An advanced decision is tricky because it's very hard for healthy people to imagine all the potential scenarios of what might happen and what you would want to do in all those particular scenarios. It can be really difficult to make that leap, and quite distressing to make that leap of, well, what would I want to happen if I did fall into a coma? A lot of people may not know. Or, you know, what would I want to happen if I did get dementia? At what point would I want to start refusing treatment?
Well, there's also the range of different situations that you would need to be ready for. If working with medical professionals has taught me anything, it's that there are no end of ways that one condition can complicate another, and one just piece of background medical history can completely change how an acute illness might affect you.
And also, there is no end of preferences for different people. It's an entirely individual decision. So this is something you should definitely talk about with your doctor. So if you are currently entirely healthy but would like to think about the future, I think an advanced statement is a really good way to go, just to get the ball rolling. If you are in a position, say you have a terminal illness or a degenerative disease, talk to your doctor about your advanced decision. And really go through all the possible scenarios with them. And it'll be distressing in the moment, but it will save both yourself, I think, and a lot of other people a lot of heartache in the future. I think they're a great idea.
It sounds like it could make a potentially extraordinarily stressful situation just a little bit easier to sort of, as it were, put on the page.
Yeah.
And understand. And when I say that, I mean for the loved ones of...
Absolutely. Living wills were first proposed actually in 1969 by an American lawyer called Louis Kuttner as a simple device to allow patients to say no to life-sustaining treatment that they didn't want, even if they were too ill to communicate. For example, if you were in a coma and while you were alive, you would express the wish, if I go into a coma, I would rather you, and there was no hope of me reviving with anything like my normal life.
Mental faculties and ability to move.
Exactly. Or if there were no hope, I don't want to be kept alive indefinitely on life support. Now, prior to 1969, that would have been a massive legal case. So this lawyer, Kuttner, basically put this forward. It deals with the issue that doctors sometimes find it hard to accept that patients might prefer death to treatment. And this is something we still struggle with today. When your job is to save people's lives, to change that mindset to, it's not necessarily about prolonging at any cost, but actually allowing someone to have, quote unquote, a good death. It's a different skill set that we're not quite so equipped to teach. And I'm sure there are some doctors out there who are fantastic at it, but it's a very tricky, sensitive subject. An advanced decision can be a really great way of taking a lot of that responsibility off of the doctor's shoulders.
Yeah.
About deciding when to stop. They'll know. And again, it can make a process a lot easier.
And put the ultimate decision in the hands of the one person who really should be at the centre of the decision-making process.
Yeah. Early attempts at using them revealed a lot of problems in translating the sort of abstract language that we use about our lifestyle into actual medical intervention, medical terminology. So what you find now as we've refined it and refined it and refined it is that there's very specific wording you use in advanced decisions. And again, that's why you should consult with a healthcare professional or a doctor or a nurse so that you know exactly what you're doing. And you know, and the doctor is very clear about what you want and what you specifically, what exactly kind of what medical intervention you're looking at whatever point in the progression of your illness or disease or your condition.
So that the language in the decision reflects exactly what you envisage as.
It's not like, oh, I just don't want to be kept alive. Well, it's like, okay, so does that mean, do you want ventilation? Do you want a feeding tube? Do you want hydration? Like, what does this entail? That's a very specific example. It's one of many of the along the spectrum. One of the main developments in advanced decisions was the introduction of the Mental Capacity Act in 2005.
In 2005?
Yeah.
Very recent.
Well, I mean, if you think about it, 1969, that's 47 years ago. Yeah. So this is a very recent development in healthcare. As our healthcare gets more sophisticated and we get better and better at prolonging life, we start to get into the ethics of not just can we prolong life, but should we prolong life? So the Mental Capacity Act has been a very important development in advanced decisions and living wills. It basically has 5 principles designed to protect people who lack the capacity to make decisions, but also maximize their ability to make decisions or participate in decision making as far as they are able to do so.
So 5 stipulations to it.
Yeah, 5 principles. A person must be assumed to have capacity unless it's established that he or she lacks it. So it has to be very clear that you lack the mental capacity to make decisions. They should not be treated as unable to make a decision unless all steps to help him or her to do so have been taken without success. So sure. You have to help people make their own decisions, and you have to do everything you can to establish they cannot make these decisions themselves.
That's the first avenue of approaching a person in that situation.
A person is not to be treated as unable to make a decision merely because he or she makes an unwise decision. So you can't say, oh, they're mentally incapable
because they voted Brexit.
Do something that you disagree with. I may not agree with that, but that doesn't mean it makes them someone mentally incapable. And therefore, the decision-making process should be taken away from them, thus disempowering them and removing their agency. That's bad.
I mean, with reference to that example we gave, that's the language in that stipulation there is very tricky. An unwise decision is very open to interpretation.
Which is why this one is very important. Any act done or decision made for on behalf of a person who lacks mental capacity must be done or made in his or her best interests. So this final one has got very sort of tricky legal language, but it basically means you have to see whether you can make this act or this decision in a way that is less restrictive of the person in question's rights and freedom of action.
Oh, I see.
So it's sort of taking the best possible course that is the least aggressive. What this act is trying to do is preserve the person in question's agency as much as possible, even though they may, at that point in time, lack the capacity to make a decision themselves. We've made huge strides with that. Some people saw it as a way of sneaking euthanasia in through the back door.
Sure.
Withdrawing treatment from someone is not the same as euthanasia. It's not the same as assisted suicide at all.
No, absolutely not. That's an entirely different area of working with someone at end of life.
Why would you want an advanced decision? Why would you want an advanced statement? It's so that you can participate in your healthcare towards the end of your life as long as you have the ability to do so. And then if you lose the ability to make decisions, those who care for you will make decisions on your behalf and you will know they are being carried out in your best interests. And they are exactly what you would have wanted in that situation.
Sure. So the agency of what happens in your end of life rests with yourself or those closest to you.
Yeah.
Those whom you trust to make decisions in your best interest.
I hope I'm selling it here.
It's a serious topic to talk about, but I think on close examination it's well worth it.
The old adage is knowledge is power. If you know what is going to happen to you after you are no longer able to make decisions, you have empowered yourself through that choice.
And you don't have to stress about those decisions if realisation that your decision-making capacity is maybe being reduced dawns. It's a very interesting point, referencing again my work with medical professionals in end-of-life care, that someone mentioned, I believe she worked in a hospice, mentioned that urinary tract infections can often manifest as confusion. Dementia is very, very often, frighteningly often, diagnosed when what's actually wrong with the person is urinary tract infection. And obviously dementia would be a big step towards deciding that someone's decision-making capabilities are compromised. So it seems like the five stipulations that you mentioned earlier would very much help out with that. Looking at the UTI possibility in someone who seems confused before you diagnose dementia would be a necessary part of that. So it seems like it
absolutely can... You have to go down every single route of establishing whether they are mentally capable of making decisions or not. Didn't know that about UTIs and confusion.
It's a scary idea, isn't it, that just your body retaining the toxins because your kidneys and bladder aren't working to full function leads to
confusion,
toxin buildup in your brain. And moving on then, this sounds to me, Rosie, like a good idea. You mentioned going and talking to your doctor about it as a sort of step towards getting one made, but what else do I need to do to get one of these two things drawn up?
You can find an absolute ton of resources on, guess where, the internet. So two places that I found very, very useful were Age UK, the charity website, and a website called My Living Will. They have particularly great packages for setting them up. It's a reasonably simple process, and there is a wealth of in-depth information on both of their sites, and I'll link to them in the show notes if you're interested in doing it. The other thing I didn't mention so far is the fact that it can actually avoid arguments about your healthcare between your loved ones and family members. So no one's going, they would have wanted this, they would have wanted that, and arguing with each other over something very distressing. One family member going, we should pull the plug, it's kinder, and the other family member going, no, I want them to stay on life support. Now, if you had an advanced decision, you would know whether the person on life support would have wanted that or not, and know whether to switch it off or not.
And in one fell swoop, it's removed a possible
point of
family sundering argument.
Yeah, exactly.
Because those things grow into terrible, terrible
relationship-ruining conversations.
Absolutely.
So if you don't place that responsibility on your family members in the first place, saving a lot of heartache. Yeah, so you go on either of these websites. They will provide you with the framework, the paperwork that you can look at. Naturally, the chances of dying increase with age. So mm-hmm. The older you are, the more important it is to have one of these. But a stroke or an accident can happen to anyone at any age. So there's no reason to wait until you're older or until you potentially get diagnosed with a terminal illness or anything like that. You know, you make the decision as long as you have the mental capacity to make the decisions. So if you do make a decision, it needs to be written down, signed by you, and signed by a witness. Right. This is the legally binding one.
This is the advanced decision.
Yeah. You get to specify clearly which treatments you would wish to refuse. You explain the circumstances in which you'd wish to refuse them. It's signed by you and by a witness. If you want to refuse life-sustaining treatment, such as life support, CPR, that kind of thing, you have made the advanced decision of your own accord without any harassment or pressure from anyone else. And you haven't said or done anything that would contradict the advanced decision since you made it. For example, saying you'd changed your mind mm-hmm. about it. This is where it gets a bit tricky, ethically. You have the final say on who sees it, but you should make sure that anyone who would potentially be involved in your care in this situation should know about it and where to find it. And you can even keep a copy in your medical records.
Right, that makes sense.
Of both of them, actually, the advanced statement and the advanced decision. It's reasonably inexpensive to make one of these.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it should cost you £10 to £15.
Oh, wow. I was thinking legal document prices.
Nope. In fact, My Living Will is a not-for-profit organisation that the charge for making a living will through that organisation is merely to sustain the organisation to keep going.
Wonderful.
It's accessible to anyone with an internet connection making one of these, which I think is great. And you can amend it as well. As I've mentioned, there are some ethical concerns about this, such as people saying they've changed their mind about certain things. It's tricky. The Mental Capacity Act has been amended since its conception. Certain things, such as the amendments, have created administrative procedures to ensure the Act's processes are observed in cases of adults who might be deprived of their independence in care homes or hospitals. So it's to protect both those adults in those situations and to protect the healthcare professionals from being prosecuted essentially under human rights legislation. Because when you start withdrawing care, there's a lot of tricky legal processes to go through so that healthcare professionals are not prosecuted for essentially killing people.
Of course, you want to keep the culpability away from the people who are fulfilling wishes.
Exactly. There's also an alternative to the living will, which is giving someone medical power of attorney.
Ah.
So rather than creating your own advanced decision and thinking through all the healthcare, you legally transfer that responsibility to someone else to make decisions upon your behalf. However, there was a study in 1998 which produced some alarming results about appointing medical proxies, which showed that terminally ill patients and their chosen surrogate healthcare decision makers were in agreement on end-of-life choices in only 66% of the cases.
That's not a particularly high percent in this context.
And you know, it is emotional, someone becoming very ill and dying, and therefore what the dying person may want and what their medical proxy may want, it's very hard to keep personal feelings about wanting to keep someone around out of making decisions for that ill person. So I can understand where the conflict would arise.
Thinking about where I might be if I were in an end-of-life situation and how I would feel about making those decisions for someone else, it feels to me like those two people that I'm imagining in my head are very conflicted.
It'd be really difficult. And it's a lot of responsibility to place on someone. I say, you want something done properly, do it yourself.
Firm but fair.
But if you think, if you have someone you trust to make decisions on your behalf at the end of your life, absolutely appoint them. The beauty of this is that we have choice. Choice is empowering, and if you make knowledgeable choices, you are empowered. It's your death. There was a very recent article in the Times on the 26th of October this year titled End of Life Cases Must Go to Court, stating that cases with advanced decisions must go before the court.
It's good to know that the Times are aware of our podcast and are programming their articles according to it. Thanks.
So it said, people's instructions in living wills for doctors to end their lives should be brought before the courts for approval before treatment is withdrawn, judges have said. Now, already there's problematic language saying doctors ending their lives. Doctors do not end people's lives.
Yeah, that's...
They withdraw treatment. That's very inflammatory reporting. A commenter, Sarah Wooten, she pointed out that the article implied that all circumstances where an advanced decision applied would need to go to court, which is not the case. The practice direction referred to in the article relates to the withholding or withdrawing of artificial nutrition and hydration from a person in a permanent vegetative or minimally conscious state. So it wouldn't apply, for example, to people with dementia or people in a coma. It would only apply in those situations.
Which is a fairly specific set of circumstances, given the range of different situations you could be.
Exactly. It doesn't apply to other forms of medical treatment or to patients who lack capacity for other reasons such as dementia. It does give cause for concern in that court involvement in cases where a patient has made an advanced decision isn't really in the spirit of the Mental Capacity Act or of patient-centered care. So the court really needs to clarify this position quite quickly. This is a very recent ruling. However, all other advanced decisions still have statutory force in England and Wales. So if you have made an advanced decision, you can refuse medical treatment. That still stands. And I believe Sarah works for Compassion in Dying, which is another great website for people who would like resources about dying with compassion.
Again, we'll make sure that's in the show notes.
Absolutely. Also, dying matters. When we're talking about advanced directives and talking, being able to have conversations about death and dying with your loved ones and just in general. The organisation Dying Matters,
that's
who
their
have
arena.
Been hugely supportive of this podcast so far, mm-hmm. are really important at helpfully spreading resources, helping you getting talking about it, providing support, providing direction to other sources of information. They are an amalgamation of lots of different strands from healthcare to funeral directors. They're an amazing organisation. Please check out Dying Matters. They're super great. I'm a big fan.
And we appreciate their support.
Yeah.
Much.
I want to leave with an anecdote by an amazing doctor.
Atul Gawande.
Yeah, Atul Gawande.
I thought you might be talking
about Atul. So he's written a book pretty much all about this called Being Mortal and about how doctors reconcile the fact that people are going to die with the idea of having to save lives. And he looks at both people who are at the end of their lives in terms of age, so people dying of old age, and people who have terminal illnesses, and looking at medical intervention in both those cases. In his book, he offers an anecdote. It looks at a family where the daughter actually asked her father, you know, what would you want? You know, what would you want? And he said, well, as long as I'm able to watch a baseball game and eat chocolate ice cream, you can keep me alive. And that totally shocked her. She didn't think that would be what he wanted. You know, he could be in any other state. He could not have the ability to speak. He could not have the ability to move. But as long as he could eat chocolate ice cream and watch a baseball game, he'd want to be kept alive. And for him, that was the marker. So it is important to have these conversations because the people around you might surprise you.
Wow, that really brings it home, actually. That anecdote really, that makes a lot of sense of what we've been saying about this.
I strongly encourage you to read his book because it's amazing. And again, it's a difficult topic. I definitely cried while reading it, but it was really, really useful in reconciling how I would feel in these situations and basically just understanding mortality and what it means to be someone with a finite amount of time on this earth. He's also written some great articles, so if you look him up, I'll put one of them in the show notes, which is referencing medical intervention at end of life and how he's called it overkill. I'll put it in the show notes.
That's Atul Gawande, AtulGawande.
So that's Living Will. I've actually already started writing an advanced statement.
And I think I'm going to start on mine very soon.
Just in case.
Because it's about time.
I'll show you where I've put it.
Please do. I need to call my dad. That'd be a fun chat.
It's worth having these conversations.
Yes, it absolutely is.
They're not going to be fun, but
no, they're not.
You'll learn something.
And they will most likely save you a terrible amount of stress later on.
British people aren't talking about this. Great at talking about this kind of thing, are we?
As evidenced by the fact we came up with some tens of thousands of euphemisms, rather than just saying the word died.
Death.
Popping one's clogs. Going trumpet cleaning.
Kicking the bucket.
Deciding hell has a better PR policy than The Office.
What?
Deciding hell has a better PR policy than The Office.
Well, this has been highly educational. Thank you so much.
Knocking sparrows.
I think we should end it there.
Farting backwards.
What?
Counting the witches.
I think we need to stop now.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for listening to Morbid Curiosities. As always, it's a great pleasure.
If you'd like to answer our listener question about what your favourite euphemism is or make one of your own, please contact us.
If you do want to make one of your own, knocking sparrows is taken, that's mine.
Oh, right, you made that one up.
And counting the witches.
So if you'd like to send us your euphemisms, you can do that. You can find us on Twitter at
JimCrackShows.
You can find us on Facebook at
facebook.com/JimCrackProductions1.
On Instagram at
JimCrackProductions.
And on our website at
www.jimcrackproductions.com.
Fantastic.
Fantastic indeed.
Please get in touch. We love to hear from you and we love all your amazing contributions to the show. It's really exciting.
Well, that's it for this week. We'll see you next week with another letter or two from the alphabet. It's about to get very interesting, ladies and gentlemen. So until then, I've been your host, George Colley.
And I've been your other host, Rosie Cole.
Stay morbid.
And stay curious.